Am I correct that this is where we are? Slide five? Okay, so I've talked about the three subatomic particles already, right? What are they? Protons, neutrons, and electrons. Which of those is the smallest? Electrons, by far, are smaller, but despite being very much smaller than protons, electrons have just as much charge as protons. Each individual electron has a -1 charge that's big enough, despite the size disparity, to completely counteract the +1 charge of a proton. And protons and neutrons are almost the same size, same mass, except that neutrons, as the name indicates, are neutral. They don't have a charge. They might or might not be present in the nucleus, neutrons, that is. You don't have a nucleus, an atomic nucleus, unless you have at least one proton. So the presence of however many protons an atom has is what defines the nucleus. That's the only place you find protons and neutrons. But there will always be at least one proton in the nucleus, otherwise you don't have a nucleus. You don't have an atom. And in addition to one or more protons, you have zero or more neutrons in any given atom. Now, when we use the word atom, we're really indicating that that's a neutral atom as opposed to an ion, which we'll talk more about in a minute. A neutral atom is electrically neutral, which means it has a certain number of protons, and therefore the only way to be electrically neutral is to have exactly the same number of electrons to counteract with negative charge the positive charge that the protons have. What is it that makes a given atom a certain element? In other words, how do you know what kind of atom you're looking at? Whether it's this one, for instance, this cartoon version, is helium. Why? I know that that's helium? Because there's two protons and no other reason. That is the only thing that defines the type of atom, the element. Because all neutrons are the same as each other, all protons are the same as each other, all electrons are the same as each other. So there aren't different kinds of atoms because there are different kinds of electrons, protons, and neutrons. Instead, what makes different kinds of atoms different elements is that they have different numbers of protons. And what do we call that number of protons for any given atom? That's called the atomic number. So each element has its own atomic number that no other element has. And that's how the periodic table of the elements is ordered. In this version, all versions are a little bit different, but in this version on the wall, the blue integers are the atomic numbers. You can see that all of these 100 or so elements are listed in order of their atomic numbers. The smallest and therefore simplest possible atom is a hydrogen atom, which is hydrogen only for one reason, because it has exactly one proton. Okay. Since we're talking about an atom rather than an ion of hydrogen, that means a hydrogen atom would therefore also have exactly one electron, so that the -1 and the +1 add up to zero neutrality. All right, let's go to six now and start talking about some spaces. This can be kind of confusing because the spaces I'm about to talk about are not structures. They are just spaces that can be occupied, but they don't have any material structure to them. And so, by rough analogy, you can think of a house, but not the actual structure of the house. Just think about a make-believe house that has walls that aren't made out of anything. In other words, there is a defined space, right? And like most houses, it's not just one room. It's compartmentalized. So there are spaces within the space. And in fact, In a typical house, you have a room, which is a space within the house, which is a space. And that room can have a space within it, like a closet. That's what we're going to be talking about. Spaces within a space. Within spaces, I should say. All right, now all of these spaces that I'm about to talk about are outside of the nucleus, which, as we've already covered, is the place where all of the protons and neutrons are, however many there are for that atom. The atomic nucleus here, no detail is shown here because that's not the point. There's some number of protons and neutrons in there. That's the nucleus. Then there's space outside of the nucleus. And the space outside the nucleus is the only place you'll find electrons. All right, but electrons occupy these spaces specific ways. And there are levels of spaces, just like there are levels of spaces in this house analogy. The entire house space would be the biggest level, and then that's broken down into subspaces within it, which would be like rooms, and those are broken down into subspaces again, which would be like closets in a sense. Okay? These biggest spaces are called either electron shells or energy levels. Those two terms are interchangeable. You can refer to it using either of those phrases. So what we see here is that the energy levels, of which there are multiple, occur, they're numbered one through whatever, with one being the level that is the space that's closest to the nucleus itself. That's the lowest energy level, because electrons are negatively charged and they are therefore attracted to the positively charged nucleus because of its protons. And it's therefore, the electrons are at their lowest energy if they're able to occupy the space that's closest to the nucleus. All right, so that's a shell, or which shell we sometimes say, and just for shorthand for electron shell, but shell and level mean the same thing. Okay, now the level is not made out of anything, like I'm saying. It's just a space. The second shell is also a space, but farther from the nucleus. All right, electrons can be in a shell, but there's a limit. And we'll talk more about the limits in a minute. What we really see being illustrated with these arrows in this figure is that any given electron is in one specific level or another, never in between. And that's why the ball on the stairs analogy is being used here. If you conduct this experiment in real life and roll a ball down the top step, depending on how you do it, it might go all the way down or it might land on a step. But it's never going to land somewhere between steps, right? It's going to be on one discrete step or another. And that's by analogy with electrons that are always, at any given moment, within one level or another, not between. Okay, now we'll talk about limits next. Limits to how many electrons can occupy these spaces we're talking about. So the energy levels are the biggest spaces. They're like the house, each one. And within levels, which are spaces themselves. The levels are just spaces. But within each level, there is some number of subspaces making up that space. And those subspaces are called subshells, which makes sense because the bigger space is the shell, right? Subspaces within that are called subshells. And then subshells, which are already subspaces of a bigger space, are made up of smaller spaces within the subshell. And those smaller spaces are called orbitals, or electron orbitals, but usually we just say orbitals. Okay, now, all of these are just spaces, but that's where you can possibly find electrons. Orbitals, even though they are not material things, they do have a specific mathematical shape. And you can see some of that in this figure, this cartoon. There are actually 5 orbitals being shown here. Think about the biggest spaces. Those are the levels, right? The shells. Shell 1, which is the closest one to the nucleus, is a space that's made up of only one subshell, called the S subshell. And so, since it's made up of only one subspace, the subspace and the overall space are really the same thing. It would be like a house, which is just one huge room. But that's just for level 1. Level 1 is made up of one subshell called the S subshell. What makes a subshell, by the way, is that it contains all of the orbitals within a level, but all of the orbitals only of one type. In this case, the S subshell is made up of all of the S orbitals that are in that shell. Is everyone following me? Yeah, a subshell contains all of the orbitals of the same type that are in one level. So let me say that there are different categories of orbitals. S, which I gave you, is only one kind of orbital. There are also P orbitals and D and F. We're going to concern ourselves in this course only with the first couple types, the S and the P, which are shown here. Some of them are, not all of them. Anyway, S orbitals are spherical shaped. And every level, one and higher, every shell, which was the previous slide, contains its own S subshell, which is made up of one S orbital. Okay? Every level has an S subshell that contains all of the S orbitals in that level, but there's only one S orbital in each level. So level 1, made up of the 1S subshell as it's named, 1S here, the 1 refers to the level. The 1S subshell is made up of only one orbital called the 1S orbital, which is spherical shaped like S orbitals are, and that's this darker circle in the middle. Okay? Level 1 is kind of an exception because that's the entire level. There's only one kind of orbital in it, and therefore there's only one subshell because each subshell is made up of all the orbitals of one type. Okay? And so you can call it a space within a space within a space, but for level 1 it's all the same space. The 1s orbital completely makes up the first level's S subshell, which completely makes up the entire level 1. Okay? Now, if we go on to higher levels, starting with level 2 and higher, in addition to its own S subshell, levels 2 and higher also contain their own P subshell. And a P subshell consists of all of the P-type orbitals in that level. Okay, now P orbitals are not spherical. P orbitals have this dumbbell shape, kind of like an infinity symbol. And so this is just one orbital, a P-type orbital. This one's another, and this one's a third. All right? If a level contains P orbitals, which it will if it's level 2 or higher, So for every level that contains p orbitals, that level has exactly 3 p orbitals in it. And those 3 p orbitals combined make up that level's p subshell. And that subshell contains only the p orbitals. That same level, for 2 and higher, will also contains an s subshell containing all of the s orbitals, but there's only one in each level. So how many levels are shown here in this cartoon? How many shells, in other words? Shell and level mean the same thing.
Two.
And their names are 1 and 2. Levels are numbered with integers starting from the closest one to the nucleus. So the first shell, like I said, really is the same thing as the first shell's S subshell, which also is really the same thing as the first level's S orbital. That's this circular, small circle. So that's one level. The next level has its own S subshell. It would be called the 2S subshell because we're in level 2. That subshell contains all of the S orbitals of that level, which there's only one of because there's only ever one S in each level. And that's the bigger circle. The 2S subshell contains the 2S orbital, and that's it. But because we're in level 2, there's a different kind of subshell in addition to the S subshell, and that's the P subshell containing all 3 of the different P orbitals in the shell. Now, each P orbital is identically shaped as far as a mathematical geometry is concerned, but the 3 P orbitals in a level are mutually orthogonal, which is just another way of saying that each one of them is at right angles to the other 2 simultaneously, like x, y, and z axes on a 3-dimensional graph. And you kind of see that, even though this is a 2-dimensional image, you can kind of see that. There's a better view, I think, in this next slide. Yes. So let's go over what I just said again now that we have it. It's kind of spread out here. This is all the same atom like we saw in the previous slide, but they're spreading it apart so you can understand the definitions of the spaces. The 1s orbital is the only thing that's in the first level's S subshell, and that S subshell is the only subshell in the entire level. So for the first shell, this is it, the whole thing. It can go by any of 3 names, really. The second shell has 2 subshells because it has 2 kinds of orbitals in it, 2 categories, S and P. Well, there's only ever one S orbital in any level, in each level. So this single 2S orbital is the only S orbital that makes up the level 2 S subshell. Level 2, though, also features a P subshell, and that contains all 3 of the P orbitals that are in that shell. All right? So you were right in saying that there were 2 levels in that picture. How many overall orbitals?
3.
No?
5.
How many subshells? 3. There's the 1s subshell. There's the 2s subshell. There's the 2p subshell. It's 5 orbitals, though, because this 1s is an orbital, this 2s is an orbital, and there's 3 different p orbitals. Sometimes they're called, they have to be called 2p when they're in level 2. There is no 1p because the first level doesn't feature any p orbitals. But they can be distinguished by using x, y, and z subscripts. So you could talk about the 2px, the 2py, the 2pz. Okay, any question on the spaces? All of those are simply spaces. They're not anything material. but they are places where electrons can be. Now we can talk about the limits. Importantly, it doesn't matter what kind of orbital we're talking about, and we're not even going to talk about the D's and the F's beyond that. They have different shapes, but we'll just leave that to chemistry. Anyway, no matter what kind of orbital you're talking about, any individual orbital can contain at most 2 electrons. So an orbital, and any given orbital has 3 possibilities. It can be empty, it can have 1 electron, or it can have 2. Only 3 possibilities. Okay? Now, chemical reactions happen in such a way, this rearrangement of particles that we talked about last time happens in such a way that electrons actually attain lower energy levels if there's a proper kind of rearrangement. That's why a reaction proceeds from left to right. It's kind of like spilling something downhill. The water, in a sense, wants to be downhill. It's a more stable situation. So stability is an important thing to talk about in chemical reactions, and in singular atoms, for that matter. Electrons, as I was saying a little bit ago, would like to be close to the oppositely charged nucleus, because opposite electrical charges attract each other. But they can do so only if there is room in the orbital that's closest to the nucleus. All right? Well, let's look at the periodic table for a second. Hydrogen is hydrogen for only one reason, namely that it has 1 proton. But a neutral atom of it also has 1 electron. And that electron, being the only electron, can easily occupy the lowest level possible, right? Energy level 1 contains 1 S subshell, which is made up of 1 S orbital, and it's empty until that electron is there, so there's room for it. Okay? Helium is the next simplest. It has 2 protons in its nucleus, and therefore has 2 electrons in the neutral atom version of it. Well, those 2 electrons can both occupy that closest to the nucleus orbital, right? The 1s orbital, like any individual orbital, can hold 2, no more than 2, though. So helium, notice, is separated from hydrogen by quite a big space on the periodic table. Helium occupies this right column. And by the way, this is a table, so you're used to thinking of rows and columns in tables, but they actually get different names for the periodic table. The columns are called groups, and the rows are called periods. And helium, along with the elements listed below it in the same column, same group, are on that right edge. And that right edge represents optimal stability. An atom is most stable if its electrons, its outermost electrons, are completely filling a subshell. Okay? Well, notice that's true for helium. Helium has 2 electrons in it, and they completely fill that 1s orbital, which makes up the 1s subshell. That makes helium very stable chemically, which means helium does not want to have anything to do with other atoms, even other helium atoms. It's content energetically because of its built-in stability just by itself. And under normal circumstances, it doesn't engage in chemical reactions with other atoms. Those ones that are on the right edge, those elements, are called the noble gases. And they are inert, meaning they don't normally undergo chemistry. All right? Everything else on the periodic table is not as stable, because everything else does not have a completely filled subshell in its outermost space. Okay, so I have to give you a couple more definitions. One word here has actually three different definitions, so you have to be careful with this word. And it's valence. It's used three different ways. They're related, but they're distinct meanings. So be careful how you use this and how you interpret it when you read it. One way to use this word is to talk about valence electrons. The valence electrons of any given atom are simply the electrons of that atom that are occupying the outermost shell. Now, I talked about shells 1 through whatever. They are there as spaces. But if a shell is entirely empty, even though it's there, we just pretend it's not there. We don't mention it in a shell unless it has at least one electron in it. Okay? Whichever shell is farthest from the nucleus but still contains at least one electron is called the valence shell. So that's another use of the word. And just to put it another way, the original definition I gave you for valence electrons, you can think of as simply any electron that's occupying a valence shell for that atom. For helium, what is the shell?
It must be one, right?
It's one. And the valence shell is therefore one. Right? Level 2 exists, we just ignore it because it's totally empty, has no electrons in it. So the valence shell, the outermost shell that has at least one electron for helium, is shell 1. And there are how many in it? How many electrons? Two. Both of the two total electrons that helium has, are in that first shell, specifically in the 1s orbital. So, for helium, the number of valence electrons is 2. The number of valence electrons is simply how many valence electrons there are for that atom. Okay, now the third way you can use this word is to talk about an atom's valence. An atom's valence is how many additional electrons are required, in other words, would have to be there, to fill up the valence shell. Well, notice what that is for helium. Helium is already filled up, right, in its valence shell. That's what makes it so stable. Everything else, though, on the periodic table, besides these noble gases, are not entirely filled. And therefore, they are all a little less stable than the ones on the right edge. And chemistry happens in such a way that the involved atoms rearrange themselves so that they become as stable as that right edge. Okay, so hydrogen has what as its valence shell?
One.
How many valence electrons?
One.
And what would its valence be? It's also one. And the reason you know it's one is because level one, which by the way corresponds to the period, the rho, which is called the period, tells you what energy level the valence shell is. The valence shell is, yes. So the period, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, those are energy levels or shells. Hydrogen has level 1 only, that's partially full. But there's a limit to how many total electrons level 1 can hold, right? Because the overall level contains only one orbital, specifically the 1s orbital. And I've already told you that an individual orbital can hold no more than 2. So 2 electrons completely fill up energy level 1. 2 is the max for that, and therefore the valence of hydrogen is that maximum, 2, minus the one that it already has, equals 1. It takes one additional one to fill it up. That's what the valence is, how many additional ones are required. Helium's already full, which is why it's content by itself. But the fact that there are only 2 total electrons that can be held in the single orbital that level 1 features is why the first period of the table contains only 2 elements. The next one contains 8, the next period. And that should make sense now based on what you've learned about orbitals. Level 2 has 2 subshells, right? An S and a P. But that means it contains 4 overall orbitals. The 2s is one orbital, and the 3 different 2p's are 3 more, for a total of 4 orbitals in level 2. Each orbital can hold up to 2. Therefore, the total collection of 4 orbitals making up level 2 can contain at most 8 electrons. You following? That's why 8 is a special number in chemistry. It's behind the so-called octet rule. It doesn't apply to level 1 because level 1 is full with 2. 2 is the special number there. But in level 2, 8 is the special number that fills that level. Now let's consider lithium. Element 3. It is lithium because it has 3 protons. It's a neutral lithium atom because it also, in addition to those 3 protons, has 3 electrons. Those electrons want to be as close to the nucleus as possible. 2 of them can occupy the 1s orbital that lithium has. Right? Just like the 2 that are filling helium. But there's another electron, and it can't go in that same level because it's full already. So it occupies one of the 4 orbitals in level 2. Plenty of room for it because that level can hold 8 since it has 4 orbitals. So lithium is nowhere near full as far as its valence shell is concerned. Its valence shell is shell 2, right? Not shell 1. And shell 2 can hold 8. It has 1 in level 2. There's 7 more spaces. That's what makes lithium unhappy, in a sense, if you let me anthropomorphize the, give human qualities to the elements. The elements would like to be like the right edge noble gases, with a full valence shell, or at least full valence subshell. Lithium's not. And therefore, lithium is reactive. It reacts with things so that it can get into a situation that's very similar to either helium or neon or one of the noble gases. Another thing I should say about the periodic table that I haven't yet.
Same question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can we therefore say that the shell, using the periodic table, the level of the shell, using the periodic table, mm-hmm. each level of the periodic table can be assigned to the shell?
Each period, which is a row, is assigned to a valence shell. So this period number is also the valence shell for that atom, for any atom in that period. Okay, now, broadly speaking, there are two major categories of elements, which are metals and nonmetals. There are actually some that are kind of in between, but broadly speaking, we're going to cut it into metals and nonmetals. And although there's a little over 100 total elements, it's not a 50-50 split. There are far fewer nonmetals than metals. The nonmetals are the ones that you see in this upper right-hand triangle. And excludes the noble gases. So, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, these are things that we're going to talk about a lot. These are nonmetals in this area. A lot of periodic tables will have like a stair step drawn here. This one doesn't. But that separates the metals from the nonmetals. Now, hydrogen, even though it's way over here on its on the left edge, is also considered a nonmetal. All right? But everything other than hydrogen that is to the left and below the stair step here is a metal, which is the vast majority of elements. All right? That'll become important when we talk about bonds, which we're getting to. The table that we see in slide 9 is just a little subset of the overall periodic table. This doesn't show beyond period 3. So this is just showing the light elements, the ones that are smallest because they have the fewest number of protons. And when I talked about the elements that make up an organism, we looked at that human body makeup. I said that a lot of the elements you don't want to have in your body at all. Well, those are the heavy ones that aren't shown here. These light ones, though, are the things that organisms are made out of, especially the first two periods. Now, what's different about this version of a periodic table compared to the one that's on the wall is that it shows these circular arrangements with dots in them. What are the dots here?
Electrons.
What are the circles? Shells, not orbitals. How do you know that they're not orbitals? Other than the fact that I just told you they're shells.
Each orbital can only hold two?
Exactly. Notice that some of these circles have more than two in them. Impossible for an orbital. So each circle here represents a shell, not a subshell or an orbital. Okay, but by drawing it this way, even though this is not the geometric arrangement in a real atom, you can make sense of this maximum number of electrons in a shell. And so lithium has three total. We can see that two of them fill up the first shell. That's why the valence shell is shell two here, because it has at least one. It's nowhere near full, though. And that's true, in general, of metals, which are the left side of the periodic table. Metals are made up of atoms whose valence shell is more empty than full. There's a lot of room left for more electrons in that same valence shell for a metal. Nonmetals, though, being over here in the right edge, are very close to the right edge because their valence shell is more full than empty. Look at fluorine here, which is the most reactive element. Fluorine is so reactive because it's just one step away from being very, very stable, like neon. And it's one step away because all it has to do is add one more electron to have a full valence subshell. That's what will give it neon's stability. And that's why it is so willing, in a sense, to react with things so that that can happen. That's why chemical reactions result in the rearrangements that they do, because things become more stable valence-wise. Now, what is fluorine's valence? It's 1. And you calculate that because you know it's in the second shell, for which 8 is the full number, right? What's the number of valence electrons for fluorine?
9
is the total number of electrons. It is 7 because valence electrons count only the ones in the outermost shell, in the valence shell. This shell 1 for fluorine is not the valence shell. It's already full and there's ones in higher levels. So the valence shell is shell 2 and there are 7 electrons in that. 7 of 9 total, but these 7 are the ones that are available for chemical reactions in a sense. If you think of two atoms, picture two atoms that have a chance of chemically reacting, well, first of all, they have to encounter each other, right? And when two atoms encounter each other, based on what you know about the structure of atoms at this point, what is it that actually come into contact with each other? The electrons, not the neutrons. They are deep into the interior of each atom. The electrons are what come into contact, and more specifically, the valence or outer electrons are what come into contact. So the non-valence electrons, which are still there, of course, are shielded. These valence electrons can be rearranged with other things to cause greater stability. So the comparatively few non-metals have valence shells that are more full than empty, but they're not completely full. Otherwise, they would be really stable like noble gases. The metals have valence shells that are more empty than full. Both of those situations, though, means that those elements aren't entirely happy, and therefore they are eligible for chemical reactions. Well, chemical reactions, we're on slide 10 now.
So, can you please go back to the next slide?
Yeah.
There's something.
Yes. Go ahead.
So, looking at the neon enemy from the second shell.
Yeah, fluorine?
I'm trying to look at neon.
Neon?
Yes.
Okay.
So, on the second shell, we have 2, 4, 6, and 8.
Right. 8 valence electrons. 10 total. Because there's 2 in the first shell. These 2 in the first shell fill up the 1s orbital. One of these pairs in the second shell fills up the 2s orbital. One pair fills up the 2px. One pair fills up the 2py. And one fills up the 2pz. So all 4 orbitals in shell 2, a single S and 3 different Ps, are now full. That's what makes neon so stable. We can say, in terms of valence, we can say that its valence is satisfied. It doesn't want to make any other changes. Everything else to the left of it on the periodic table is at least partially dissatisfied. Its valence is not satisfied. Okay? Does that answer your question? Then let's talk about bonds, starting in slide 10. When a chemical reaction occurs, what happens is that some chemical bonds are broken and some chemical bonds are formed. That's the rearrangement of particles that we keep talking about. But I said chemical bond just now, and I want you to realize that not all bonds are chemical bonds. For instance, later we'll talk about hydrogen bonds. Those are not chemical bonds. They're bonds, and bonds hold things together by nature of being a bond. but not all bonds are chemical bonds. So what is it that makes the distinction? What distinguishes a chemical bond? It is a bond that, if it is made, will result in new substance. And here, we're looking at an example, the same example that we started with for a chemical reaction, sodium and chlorine reacting to form sodium chloride. This involves the formation of a chemical bond. It's a chemical bond because when it's made, you no longer have the same stuff you started with. You don't have sodium, you don't have chlorine. You have a new substance called sodium chloride. Well, not all bonds do that. Not all bonds result in new stuff. But chemical bonds do, and that's why they're called chemical bonds. You have new chemicals. All right? So that's chemical bonds as a big set. There are two, in this course, we're going to talk about two major categories of chemical bonds. So we're splitting the whole big bond set into two. And those are ionic bonds and covalent bonds. There are other chemical bonds, but I'll leave that to a chemistry professor if you study those. Here we're concerning ourselves with ionic and covalent. And ionic, as the name indicates, involves ions. So first we better give a formal definition of an ion, which almost certainly you've heard the word ion, right? Who wants to define what an ion is? Right, it is a charged particle. It can be a single atom or a group of atoms, but let's start talking about it in terms of a single atom having a charge. Well, this is why I said up to now that when we use the word atom, we really are indicating implicitly that we're talking about a non-charged atom. The word atom means that it's uncharged. That's why you know it has just as many electrons as protons. But that doesn't have to be the case. An atom that is charged is usually not called an atom. It's called an ion instead. And first of all, just think about the mathematical possibilities here. In order for an atom to be charged, considering that it's made up of protons and electrons and neutrons, which don't affect the charge, there's really only one way that this, one general way this can happen, right? Logically and mathematically. And that, and specifically what I'm talking about is there can be a charge only if the number of protons does not equal the number of electrons. Is that clear? Yeah, you're going to have a charge only if the number of protons does not equal the number of electrons. Because if they do equal, then you have an uncharged atom, right? Seven negatives plus seven positives means zero overall, no charge. But if the two, the number of protons and number of electrons, do not equal, then there is going to be some charge. Well, notice that can happen in either of two directions. If there are more protons than electrons, what's the charge going to be overall? Positive, either positive 1 or positive 2 or higher. Depends on what the disparity between the numbers of electrons and protons is. And if it's the converse case, if the number of electrons is smaller than the number of protons, or no, we just said that. If the number of protons is fewer than the number of electrons, then overall you're going to have a negative charge to some degree, negative 1 or higher. So if you just think of collection of protons and electrons that you have to work with, really you could say that there's four different ways you could produce an ion from an atom. There aren't, but it makes sense to think that there could be four ways. Because you could take away protons. That would be one way. You could add protons. In both of those cases, I'm keeping the number of electrons the same, right? If I take away protons or I add protons, I would be changing the overall charge. So that's two ways. Or you could take away electrons or add electrons. Any of those four would make a charge disparity. But only two of those happen. In normal chemistry, in chemical reactions, the proton number stays the same. The protons in the nucleus shielded away from the exterior, right? So ions are formed not by adjusting the number of protons, because if you did that, you would no longer have the same kind of element, right? Elements are defined by the number of protons. Proton number stays the same in all cases. But you still have two different ways to make an ion, therefore, even keeping the protons the same. You can add electrons or you can take away electrons. Either one will result in the condition in which it is no longer true that the number of electrons equals the number of protons, and therefore it adds up to some non-zero charge. That's an ion. And we don't use the word atom anymore, we use the word ion. But there's two different directions, right? You can have more electrons than protons, that would be a negative ion. You can have fewer electrons than protons, that would be a positive ion. And we give separate names to those categories. A positively charged ion is called a cation, and a negatively charged ion is called an anion. Together, they make up the whole set of ions. In other words, any given ion is either a cation or an anion. Okay. Let's look at this specific example to make sense of this. What we see here is the formation of an ionic bond. This is not covalent. We'll get to covalent next. Ionic bonds, by the way, not only involve ions. That explains the name. But, and not only are they chemical bonds, like I said they are, but they are by far the weakest of the chemical bonds. They're not the weakest bonds, but they're the weakest chemical bonds. Weakest kind of bond that results in new substance. All right, covalent, which we'll get to, are much stronger. But anyway, an ionic bond forms between two specific kinds of atoms, one of which is a metal, the other of which is a nonmetal. So that's just in general true. Ionic bonds form between a metal and a nonmetal. They are ideally suited to make a transfer of electrons, one or more electrons, which is what happens in the formation of an ionic bond. You start with two neutral atoms, one of which is a metal, one of which is a nonmetal. In this example, the metal is sodium. The nonmetal is chlorine. Notice chlorine's up there in that little triangle in the upper right, where nonmetals are. Okay, sodium, which is the first group, the first column, but it's period 3 on the periodic table, because its valence shell is shell 3. That exists the way it is because sodium, when you look at its atomic number, is 11. Sodium is sodium because it has 11 protons, right? Well, to start with, therefore, as a neutral atom, it has 11 electrons, two of which fill up shell 1 entirely, 8 more of which fill up shell 2 entirely. That leaves one more, and that's why its valence shell is 3, because you can't fit it in the lower shell anymore. That extra one has to go in shell 3. So, its valence shell is 3. It has one valence electron, right? But it's nowhere near filling up its valence shell. It has only one. It can hold 7 more, at least the subshell we're talking about. Okay, so 8 is an important number in the third one as well. Well, if you think about satisfying sodium's valence, you could do that by adding 7 more electrons to get to 8. But that is a lot harder than simply getting rid of its valence electron, the only one in that outer shell. Because if you get rid of that one, that outer shell is now empty, which means we don't consider it anymore. And therefore, the valence shell would now be shell 2, the outermost one that has ones in it. And it's already full, just like neon. That makes sodium much more stable when it's like neon. And so that's why metals in general, not just sodium, but metals, since they have a valence shell that is more empty than full, are more likely to make ions by losing electrons rather than gaining electrons. They lose electrons to drop down to a valence shell that's just like the previous noble gas on the periodic table. In this case, it would be like neon. Well, chlorine as a nonmetal is in the opposite situation. Nonmetals have valence shells that are more full than empty, so it's easier to add a small number of electrons to them than it is to take away a bigger number of electrons. Exactly the opposite as the situation for sodium. Right? It's still the same valence shell for chlorine, 3, but there are 7 electrons in that valence shell. So 7 valence electrons for chlorine means that its valence is 1, 8 minus 7. It needs one more to fill it. And so if it strikes a deal with a sodium, it's a perfect situation, right? Because sodium wants to give up one, chlorine wants to take one on. And if that happens, that transfer of just one electron, only one particle involved, will simultaneously satisfy both atoms by making them ions. But notice that the metallic atom, sodium, loses the electron, so it becomes charged in which way? It becomes positive. It has the same number of positives, but now it has one fewer negative. So they add up to positive 1. Metals form ions by losing electrons, which makes them cations. Metals lose electrons to become ions, and specifically that makes them positively charged ions, which are called cations. Exactly this reverse situation for nonmetals. Since they're more full than empty, they form ions by taking on additional electrons, which makes their negatives outnumber their positives, and therefore they become negative ions, which are called anions. Ionic bonds, therefore, are distinguished from other chemical bonds because the formation of an ionic bond involves the more or less permanent transfer of at least one electron from a metal to a nonmetal, simultaneously forming 2 different ions. Each of the 2 involved atoms is no longer neutral. Each one has become ionized. But in opposite directions, right? This is why it always features a metal and a nonmetal. Because in order for this to be a bond, which is a force of attraction between them, after the transfer of an electron is made, there has to be opposite charge. A positive ion will repel another positive ion. A negative ion will repel another negative ion. But if you have an anion and a cation, one of them negative, one of them positive, they will attract each other because there is an attraction between opposite charges, electrically speaking.
That's when you call it an ionic bond.
Right. Once these 2 ions are formed because of the transfer of the electron, these 2 ions with their opposite charges, one positive and one negative, are going to mutually attract. They'll attract each other, in other words. And that force of electrostatic attraction because of the opposite charges is what holds the two ions together. That's what accounts for the bond, the electrostatic force of attraction. All right? Now, it holds them together well enough that you no longer have sodium and chlorine. Now you have a compound rather than two elements. You have a compound now with a metallic and a non-metallic component, but the overall thing is one compound, a new substance, sodium chloride, which is we know as table salt, but there's all kinds of different salts. Salt, chemically speaking, simply refers to an ionic compound. The bond is ionic, and the compound that results from that ionic bond is also called an ionic compound. Remember that more generally speaking, a compound is a substance made up of at least two different kinds of elements. In this case, two exactly. So there are other compounds besides ionic compounds, but compounds that are formed because ionic bonds hold them together are called ionic compounds. An ionic compound and salt are interchangeable. There's all kinds of different salts because there's different kinds of metals and nonmetals that can undergo this same process. Although it might be some other number of electrons rather than one that's exchanged. By the way, notice that one here is what satisfies the valence. If you had magnesium instead of sodium, it has two valence electrons, right? So its valence would be six. It can take on six more. And so it wouldn't be enough to transfer just one. That would make it like sodium, which isn't satisfied yet. Magnesium, if it's going to form an ion, needs to lose two. But if the compound is made because of ionic bonds, then it's an ionic compound. We see sodium chloride in slide 11. Cartoon form and photographic form. A crystal of salt. There's something that I need to get out of the way nomenclature-wise. For instance, if I were to just randomly poll people on the street and ask them whether a single molecule of salt is possible, I think probably most people would say yes. Were you thinking yes? It's not true. Molecule is a word that we reserve for other kinds of compounds, for other kinds of bonds. Okay, compounds are not even necessarily compounds. Bonds that are covalent, which we haven't talked about yet, as opposed to ionic, those result in molecules. There are no molecules of salt, and here's why. A piece of salt can be arbitrarily big. It can be as big as you want as long as there's enough ions. You know, we looked at, in the previous slide, at the example of this reaction occurring with just a single sodium atom and a single chlorine atom. Well, that's nonsensical. That never really happens in nature. There are trillions and trillions of each of them, even in the tiniest samples. But each pair exchanges one electron to become two different ions. When an ion is formed, though, when that sodium ion is formed and it's positively charged because of its loss of an electron, it is positive looking, in a sense, to other particles in all directions. It's not just positive in one direction. Right? Similarly, the chloride ion gets, when it's an ion, the nonmetals change their name. Chloride, by receiving that extra electron, is negatively charged, but it's negatively charged in all directions. So if you have one of each, they will stick together like in the previous slide. But if you have trillions of each, then they will form a crystal because each ion individually is attracting the oppositely charged ions around it in all directions simultaneously. The yellow, each yellow is attracted to several different greens around it. And if you just keep adding ions of both types, you can make this thing as big as you want. And when salt is mined, you know, for use for sale to humans, they mine salt crystals that are much bigger than buildings. It's all one piece. Now that's distinct from molecular substances. Because you can have as much water as you want. Water is a molecular compound. But it's made up of pieces, individual pieces that are a defined size. Each molecule is exactly one oxygen and exactly two hydrogens, and that's it. You can have a hell of a lot of copies of that, but they're not stuck together. Each one is a complete molecule. You see the difference here? That's not the case for salts. So we don't use the word molecule to refer to ionic compounds or salts, but we still can define the smallest piece of a salt. And in this case, it would be exactly one sodium ion and exactly one chloride ion, because if you don't have that bare minimum, you can't possibly have sodium chloride. You can have as much as you want, make the chunk as big as you want, but the smallest possible chunk is called the formula unit for a salt. Because the formula tells you how many. Sodium chloride is NaCl. Well, when it's 1, we just don't even bother writing it. It's really Na1Cl1. So the formula unit is exactly 1 of each of those. For something that has other subscripts in its formula, the formula unit would be accordingly. All right? Those are ionic compounds resulting in salts. Let's go to the second major category of chemical bonds, which is covalent bonds. And linguistically, co means share. Like the co-stars of a movie, share the lead. Notice that it includes a form of the word valence. This goes hand in hand with what I was telling you before. When two atoms encounter each other and have any hopes of chemically reacting, what actually come into contact are the not just the electrons, but specifically the valence electrons. All right? Well, covalent is a word that means there is a sharing of valence electrons between the two participants. That's not true for ionic compounds because there it's an exchange, right? One of them wants to get rid of it. One of them wants to take it on as its own. So they're not shared. It's transferred. But in covalent bonds, there is a sharing. Very importantly, it is never a single electron that is shared in a covalent bond. It is always some number of pairs of electrons. The simplest possible covalent bond, which we call a single covalent bond, consists of two electrons. It's a single bond, but it's made up of two electrons, one from each of the two participating atoms. And here's where valence really matters, the way I define valence. Also, let me add that unlike an ionic bond that always involves a metal and a nonmetal, a covalent bond always forms between a nonmetal and a nonmetal. Now, I said that intentionally instead of saying two nonmetals because it can be two of the same nonmetal. It doesn't have to be two different nonmetals. But both atoms have to be nonmetal for it to be a covalent bond. And remember that in addition to that triangle in the upper right, hydrogen is also a nonmetal, despite its position on the periodic table. So that relatively few number of nonmetals that exist in nature can be rearranged, or they can be combined with each other limitless ways. And that's why these few nonmetals can result in millions of different compounds. But we're looking here at the simplest possible example using two identical hydrogens, each of which is the simplest possible atom. Remember, hydrogen is a nonmetal. So you have two nonmetals here. They happen to be the same nonmetal, which is fine. When they get close to each other, their electron clouds meet. Their valence electrons come into contact, in other words. But let's think about what the situation is before any sharing occurs. Hydrogen's valence shell is shell 1. It has one valence electron. And what is its valence? Also 1, just by coincidence. Its valence is 1 because shell 1 features a maximum of 2, right? So it's 2 minus 1 equals 1 again. Its valence is 1, though. You can think of this, probably help you to think about it as far as the periodic table is concerned. Its valence is 1 because it is one step away from the right edge. Fluorine also has a valence of 1 because it's one step from the right edge. Oxygen has a valence of 2. All right? So hydrogen, each individual hydrogen atom has a valence of 1, meaning it can take on one more electron, and that's what it wants to do because that will make it stable like helium. The other one is in the identical situation. So each one is greedy. Each one will say, let me have that electron from you. But no one wins out. No one agrees to that unfair deal, right? Instead, if they agree to each share its one with the other, then both of them get credit for both electrons. Even though there's two total electrons, each of the two involved with sharing that pair will get credit for having that pair. And that will make both hydrogen atoms stable like helium. That's what a covalent bond is. And this is why it's never one. It's always one from each of the atoms, or two from each of the atoms. It's always some number of pairs of electrons that are shared. If it's exactly one pair, then we call that a single covalent bond, and that's what's happening here. The electrons, there's two total electrons, one from each hydrogen. And like I said, at any given moment, we don't know where they are. But we know that they are spending some time around each of the two atomic nuclei. So they're not following an orbit like this, but you can think of that way in your head if it helps you. Right? They're never permanently with one atom or the other. And that is what holds these two together, that sharing. And it holds them together a hell of a lot better than the electrostatic force of opposite charges in an ionic bond. It's a chemical bond also, so you have new stuff with new properties. This is no longer two hydrogen atoms, it's one hydrogen molecule. But it's not only a chemical bond, meaning it's new stuff, it's much more strongly held together than an ionic bond is. Now, let me see what the next picture is. I forget. The next picture just shows you that there can be such things as higher level covalent bonds. We see the single covalent bond that we just looked at, but here using chemical formulae. These are not traditional formulae. Usually we just have the H. These things with the dots are called electron dot diagrams. In an electron dot diagram, you write down the symbol for the element to represent the nucleus. So the H tells you that it's hydrogen, and that's where the proton is. What we care about, though, are some of the electrons, not all of them necessarily, specifically valence electrons. Those are the ones that are involved in sharing. So only the valence electrons are represented by dots for any given atom. In this case, the valence electron happens to be the only electron that the whole atom has. Other one has one valence electron as well. And when you put them together, you have a shared pair highlighted in blue. That's a single covalent bond. That holds them together. Oxygen, notice on the periodic table, is element 8. It has 8 electrons. But it has only 6 valence electrons, right? Because the first two of those fill up shell 1. Shell 2 can hold 8, which is why the valence of oxygen is 2. It's 2 steps away from neon, 2 steps away from the right edge. So another way of thinking about valence when it comes to nonmetals is that the valence tells you how many bonds that atom needs to make in the molecule that it's part of in order to be satisfied. But I'm running out of time, so I'll let you go.